Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the session on titled Better Together, Welcoming People with Developmental Disabilities into Congregational Life. I'm really actually excited that the room is filling up. This is really great. This is the third sort of in a series of sessions we've had today that have focused on topics related to hospitality and using everyone's gifts in a congregation that have all sort of focused around, though, individuals with developmental disabilities or disabilities in general, because so often that's a segment of our communities and our congregations who don't have the same opportunities to participate and share their gifts with others. And so that's really what I want to focus on, is how congregations really are better when we use and draw in everyone's gifts, particularly people with developmental disabilities. So I'll tell you just a little bit about myself, because I think I'm maybe an unusual speaker for a worship symposium. I'm actually an assistant professor of special education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and primarily my job is as a researcher, and I do work around research on how do we include people with the most significant disabilities in the life of our schools, in the life of our workplaces, in the life of our communities, and that includes our congregational communities. How do we do that well? But the interesting take on my line of research is it's less about how do we do that well for people with disabilities, but what's the impact on others in those classrooms or in those workplaces, in our community settings, our neighborhoods, and in our congregations when we strive to include everyone. And the answer is, the recurring theme is that inclusion is usually good for everyone. And so I want to focus on individuals with disabilities in this particular talk, but I think a lot of this conversation could be about anyone. So I only have, I guess, 58 minutes now, and it turns out I have 4.5 hours of things to cover. Turns out this is the last session of the day, so you can really just stick with me. There's really no reason you don't have to go anywhere else, it turns out. That's right, there's church. I can't squeeze into that. So in 58 minutes, I do want to talk about this idea of becoming a welcoming congregation and becoming more welcoming as a journey, because I think it is a journey that we're all entering at different points and are sort of at different points along the way, and talk about some metaphors that might help you think about that journey. And then I'll talk a little bit about what compels us on that journey. What's the call for congregations to be places of welcome and belonging for all individuals, particularly for individuals with disabilities? And the need that exists in every community, or I shouldn't say the need, the opportunity that exists in every community outside of our congregation doors, of people who'd like to be part of our congregations, but maybe we don't know how to welcome so well. So I'll talk a little about the need and what stands in the way, the barriers that are preventing many people with disabilities from being involved in the ways they'd like. But I want to spend most of the time not sort of dwelling on those pieces, but really what are some strategies, some practical things that we can do as a congregation to figure out where are we and what might be our next steps. I think I can only whet your appetite in some areas in the short amount of time, but I want to just give you some questions to think about and some considerations, and then I'll point you to some tools if this is something you're going to go sort of deeper with your congregation when you leave at this point. So I'll leave you with some next steps. How many of you are pastors, congregational leaders, those sorts of things? Okay. How many of you are children's ministry leaders in your church or are involved with that, some of you? Many of you are parents of children, either children or young adults with disabilities, some of you. So there's a range of folks here. One of the things I just want to start with as I sort of go through this talk, I hope you'll kind of hold these questions in mind, because we use this often in community building around how do we make our school more inclusive, our community more welcoming. We sort of pose these questions so people don't get bogged down in the negative and what we're not doing, but can really focus on where we are and how we move forward. And I think these questions are really helpful. The first is just what are we doing well right now? Because probably every congregation is doing something really well in this area, and it's good to use that as a starting point. So what are we doing well now kind of gets us out of that negative. Second question is, what can we do better, which sort of drives us to how can we improve what we're doing. Question three is, what could we be doing differently, which is really challenging us to be more creative in our response in these areas. And question four is, really, what can we begin doing right now? So what can our first step be? So as you're listening to all the things I share, thinking about, well, we're doing really well in that area, we could be doing better in this particular area, and wow, I hadn't thought about it, but we could probably do things differently in this area, and when I go back to my congregation, here's the first thing I'd like to start with. Those are what we call four simple questions in community building, and if those sort of intrigue you, I put a website for where you might sort of download some resources on how those kinds of questions are being applied to a lot of issues. So let's start with this idea of the journey. I like this metaphor of the journey, sort of a quest, because I think it's relates to this idea of how do we move forward from being the congregation that we are now to being one that includes a wide range of people, including people with disabilities. How many of you love Lord of the Rings? Like Lord of the Rings? I love it. That is a quest. It is a journey. And I think in every good journey, there's always a call, right? There's sort of that call to launch that journey. We certainly have that. There's a starting point for everyone on that journey, and it's usually different for every person. And that's true in this case. Every congregation is kind of in a different place on that journey, but we all have that same call. And then, of course, there's a destination, a place that we want to go. And sort of in this conversation, I often think of that destination as a church where people with and without disabilities are worshiping together, alongside each other, fellowshipping together, learning together, and serving together. Together, not apart or not separately. And that might be where we want to go. So to take this metaphor even further, probably too far, if we do think about it as journey, how many of you remember elementary school when you talked about prepositions? How many of you thought you would never have to deal with those again? I want to just use those to illustrate this notion of this journey. A gentleman by the name of Bill Gaventa, who's kind of a leader in disability ministry, uses this idea often. And thinking about how we do ministry in relation to people with disabilities. In many congregations across the country, ministry is actually done apart from people with disabilities. Much of what happens in a church doesn't involve people with disabilities. If we look at our pews, at our pulpit, at our worship teams, at things going on behind the scenes, our children's ministry, people with disabilities simply aren't present. That's the starting point for many people on this journey. Another sort of place that many congregations often are is in doing ministry to people with disabilities. Notice the different preposition, with and then to. And that's probably very important work also, ministry to people. And it might be that we're doing some sort of outreach effort or doing some sort of respite care. And all of those things are very valuable and very important parts, but that shouldn't be all that we're doing, ministry to people. So sometimes congregations will move as part of their journey to ministry among people with disabilities. And that often, in many congregations, the starting point is starting a separate class for individuals with developmental disabilities, or a separate class for individuals with autism, or a separate worship service, a variety of things like that. That's ministry among. We can be in the same building, but not really be worshiping and living life together. And so we can be sort of doing worship parallel to, but not actually interacting, and our lives don't interact. So we want to move further on the journey to ministry with people with disabilities. And that's evidence when we are worshiping together and alongside each other. And I'll talk about, as we go throughout this, talk some strategies for moving us along this journey. But I think what most people I talk with who've been doing this kind of work and on this journey for a long time, when they start doing ministry with people with disabilities, they very quickly stop talking about with, and they start talking about ministry by people with disabilities. That just the same way as we do ministry for others, that we have gifts that we need to receive from individuals with disabilities that often don't have an opportunity to be shared. And that's really what we're called to do, is do ministry with and also ministry by. So that's, I think, a bit of the metaphor that you might sort of mull around in your mind. As you think about congregations you're familiar with, where would you put yourself or most congregations you know on that journey? Let me rephrase that in a way that elicits a response. how many of you sort of think of the congregations you're familiar with are doing ministry apart from people with disabilities? So how about ministry to? Is that a few? Ministry among? Is it happening sort of in the same place, but not ministry with? Ministry by. And I often talk, depends on who we're talking about when we talk about people with disabilities. It's a very diverse group of people. I think, as I said, the idea of this journey really starts with the call. And I am not a theologian. I'm an assistant professor at a public university. So this is probably a little bold for me to try to lay out a theology of hospitality and inclusion. So I'm actually not going to do that. I did, however, spend quite a bit of time looking at how different denominational groups and faith groups articulated the importance of this work. You know, many denominations, maybe yours, have written often eloquent policy statements or resolutions or acts. They're called different things in different denominations that really call upon their congregation to live out this ideal of inclusive congregations that include people with disabilities. So if you ever have spare time, you might want to do this. I sat down and read through all of these different resolutions from various denominations. And these were the themes that came out of those. These were sort of the themes that were laced across those different statements. And if you're in a particular congregation, you might want to look at your denominational statement as a way of sort of rallying efforts in your church and casting that vision. Those of you who are, for example, in the Christian Reformed Church, there's a number of resolutions to the synod, I think is what they're called, that relate specifically to why it's important for Christian Reformed churches to be responsive in this way. And I have a list of them up here if you're wondering what yours are afterwards. I can share those with you. But I'll walk through just a couple of those and just share some of those before we get into the how do we respond to these. And the first that's pretty consistent across almost all of these denominational statements is begins with the notion of how we were all designed, that we're all created in God's image. You're all very familiar with these verses, and created to be in relationship with God and others. But, you know, as a society, we often place high value on what we perceive people can do and what they can offer, and we tend to sort of segregate what we don't value in many ways. And I think the idea here is that in God's economy, value is certainly weighed very differently, and it's not how much we can offer or how much we how many degrees we have, or how good-looking we are, or how much we earn gives us worth. It's simply the image, and that's unrestricted. It's not diminished by disability in any way. Another theme that runs across all of those statements is the simple notion that we're all called. That call, I think we learn as much about what God doesn't say about disabilities as we do as what he does. And God invites all people to worship, to fellowship, to learn, to serve, and that invitation never has a qualifier or a footnote, right? So this isn't in my Bible. I'm not trying to show you a new paraphrase. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations. All is not sometimes translated most. And yet, our communities, 19% of all of our communities include people with disabilities. So in a sense, you might think our congregations would reflect that same diversity. To take this probably too far, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. Whoever doesn't include important exceptions. And yet, when we look at many of our congregationals, who's in our congregations, we might extrapolate these asterisks in a sense. For we are God's workmanship. We means me, not necessarily you. Another theme cuts across many of these denominational statements is the idea of churches being many members, one body. The church is the body of Christ. We're integrally related members of one another. And so those social divisions, right, those social divisions certainly of Paul's day of Jew and Greek and slave and free and male and female, those aren't applicable in the body. And I think all of the ways that society labels people now and sort of divides and classifies, whether along ethnic or racial or economic or disability lines, just are contrary to what the kingdom should be and what the church should be. And that's articulated in many of these statements. You'd see some of these verses. And I think I've got all of these down on your handouts, I hope. But there may be conversations in adult Bible studies or other contexts about what this really looks like in your church. We're incomplete without your gifts. I love this verse, and this is a paraphrase from the Message. Every person is given something to do that shows who God is. Everyone gets in on it, everyone benefits. So the Spirit gives us all gifts. All those gifts are important. No one gifts are more important than anyone else's. We don't choose our gifts, and our task really is to seek out the gifts in one another and then claim them for the mission. And too often the gifts of people with disabilities are often overlooked. We think of people in terms of what we can do and share for them rather than what they can share back with us. And that certainly includes my own story, I think, but the other theme is all are needed, our independence. We can't undervalue, overlook, or fail to make use of the gifts of people that people bring to our church, that we all need everyone's gifts, and that we're missing something important when those are not present, and that those gifts are really shared through relationships. kind of move through these faster, because I think these are probably all familiar, certainly to you. But the parable of the great banquet gives that sneak peek into the kingdom and overturns community expectations about who are excluded and who are at the margins of society. Those are the ones who are brought and invited to the table, and that certainly included people with disabilities. And then, of course, the example of Christ. When we look at who he spent his time with, who his ministry was among, it was in the company of the marginalized of his day. And certainly today, people with disabilities are often among the most marginalized in our society. And so that ministry of presence is one that we're also called to practice. And then two more that came out in just a few of these different denominational statements. One is that we are all called. We're each called. Each congregation is called to this work. I love this statement. It says, we're a single flock under the care of a single shepherd. There can be no separate church for persons with disabilities. It's our congregation that's called to this, these efforts. We're not supposed to have a ministry simply of referral, referring someone down to the congregation down the street, but to have a ministry of relationships and presence. And while we don't have to do everything and we can't be everything to all people necessarily, we can't primarily have that ministry of referral, which we often hear. Well, there's a church down the street that does ministry to people with autism, or the church down the street has interpreters, so maybe that's a better home for you. If that's our exclusive ministry, that's we're missing, I think, this. And the last thing I'll just add is my sense is that we're called to be distinctive in our response as the church. And you may or may not know this, but for more than 30 years, it's been federal law that schools have to include people with disabilities in classes. For more than 30 years, that's been the case. You know, businesses can't exclude people on the basis of a disability. And virtually every public space has to be accessible to people with disabilities. So too often, though, the church doesn't reflect those same innovations. And so if everyone else is under sort of a legal mandate to include people, we should, I think we shouldn't need that same legal mandate. We should be doing it for other reasons, certainly, and to be an example of our culture, of a place that people can not be marginalized but be welcomed. So, as I said, I'm not a theologian, so I'll point you to some great resources that really talk about these themes in much greater detail. But I just wanted to give you a sense of some of the things that, at the denominational level, there's great resources on articulating why this is important within the context of that denominational tradition, and to share some of those with you. But here's some great resources you can share with your pastor or others. I wanted to spend time mostly talking about the need. You might say, that's great, I hear the call, but you know what? There's not people with disabilities in our congregation. If there were, we'd certainly be welcoming, right? Wow. So I think the question is, who's in our congregation, in our community rather, that may or may not be in our congregation? And so here's some facts you may or may not be familiar with. But in America, in the United States, there are more than 12 million people with mental disabilities, more than 9 million people with sensory disabilities, and more than 21 million people with physical disabilities. So about 20% of our communities have disabilities. All you have to do is take your town's population and divide it by 5, and that's the number of people with disabilities in your community. And so if that's our community, 19% have disabilities and 81% are temporarily without disabilities. And I say temporarily because if you know the statistics, more than half of us will have a disability at some point in our life. I think it's actually higher than that. So we're all sort of temporarily able-bodied at any given point. But it should challenge us to think about, how does our congregation reflect the demographics of our community in this sense? And some congregations are really doing well at weaving people in, and others, it's just not on their radar. And so I spent a little bit of time just to sort of illustrate this point. I did a flyover of the neighborhood just to west of Calvin. Actually, I didn't do that. That was a joke, not a lie, because I'm being taped, right? So I did Google images. This is the neighborhood that lies just to the west of this campus where we are. If you were going to go out that direction, clearly it wasn't taken in winter. If you were to take those statistics and put your church here and extrapolate that to the neighborhood that surrounds your congregation, this is where people with disabilities live, all of those little red circles. 1 in 4 families has a relative with a disability in the United States. 1 in 5 people have a disability. So people are in our communities. Are they in our congregations? And if they're not, how can we find ways of weaving them in and drawing them in? Does that surprise you, those statistics? I see some nods. They're true. Those are cross-cultural and international statistics, too. It's usually 20 to 25% in any given country has some sort of some type of disability. Now, here's the challenge, I think, for the church. So I've sort of shared with you the numbers of people with disabilities. Here's some statistics that come from the National Organization of Disability. Every 4 years, they have a national poll that explores various aspects of community living for individuals with disabilities. One of the questions that they ask every 4 years is, do you attend church at least once a month? So how many of you in here attend church at least once a month? Okay, so this is a biased sample, clearly. This is a national sample. 65% of people without disabilities said they attend church once a month. If you have a significant disability, only 44% of people say they attend church once a month. There's a 20 percentage point difference there, and we often call that the participation gap. And I mentioned that gap this morning. So how do we explain that? It could be that faith simply isn't important to people with disabilities, right? Is that a possibility? No. You're supposed to shout out, no, absolutely not. Right. In the exact same survey, they asked the question, how important is your faith to you? And the percentage of people who said it's somewhat to very important to them, it did not differ between people with and without disabilities. In fact, you don't have to be a researcher or a statistician to see that. There's simply no difference. So something else is standing in the way, and there might be some things that we need to do. The barrier isn't in people with disabilities. It's within our congregations and how we welcome and how we extend invitations. I think that's the place we need to focus on. And the last thing I want to highlight in terms of the need before I sort of walk through sort of how we respond to this is the needs of families, and there's certainly some families who are here. As I said, there are 20 million families in the United States who have an individual disability as a relative, 21 million families. We're in the midst of a research project where we are actually surveying families of children with disabilities about the responsiveness of their congregation to a variety of needs. And we'll be anxious to be able to share this back with you in a forum when we're done with the analysis. But I did just want to share with you a couple of things that we've learned from these parents. This is, involves 250 parents from several states. We asked them, have you ever refrained from participating in a religious activity because your child was not included? And almost half said yes. We were also interested if this was something that happened long ago or is this something that happened recently? For most of the families, it was something that happened in the past year. So they're not participating because their child's not welcomed or hasn't been supported. Have you ever kept your child from participating in a religious activity because support was not provided? More than half of all parents that we surveyed said yes, 57% said. These are parents of children with disabilities. However, they're not parents of children with disabilities. Boy, that sounded contradictory. They're not necessarily under 18. Some of their children may be older in that sense. The majority were school-aged children with disabilities. And we haven't looked, and I think a lot of those numbers that are, this happened 10 years ago, are of parents of older children. This had also been very recent. Have you ever been asked or expected to stay with your child at a religious activity so your child could participate? Again, more than half indicated they'd done that, and again, it was in the most recent year. And one of the things I get to talk with a lot of parents, the story I hear over and over is often some variation on we started where myself would stay with my child or stay home with my child, my spouse would attend worship services, and we'd alternate. And after a time, we got tired of alternating, and we just stopped going altogether. And that's a story I hear. Well, once hearing it once is too much, but I hear over and over and over. So these are very real felt issues and are very recent issues for many families. And on the last one, I don't have the right title up here, but we did ask whether their church had asked them how best they could support their child to participate in Christian education programs. And half said, almost half said, yes, my church has asked that. So we're starting to see movements that churches are starting to have these conversations and saying, look, we don't maybe know how to do this well, but we want to learn how can we best support you and your family. And so that is happening more and more, and that's an encouraging sign. So that's the need, and yet there are many barriers that keep people from being involved in our church. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on them except to highlight a story. Many of you have maybe saw in the last year this came out. This is a story out of Minnesota. Sheriff to mom of autistic son, don't go to church. A story about a church that issued a restraining order on an individual with autism. And this is a very complicated story, more than that headline makes sense. But in many congregations, there's just struggle with what do we do? How do we welcome kids who often seem very, very different? And there's a variety of barriers. I can give you the link. I think I can pull up to this if anyone's interested in reading more about that. But there's a variety of barriers: architectural, transportation, attitudinal, communication, liturgical barriers, programmatic barriers, and we talk a lot about those and have some resources in some of the writings that we've done to sort of navigate around those. But I want to move now away from the call and the need and talk about how we might sort of launch those journeys in our congregations. And this is just a little bit of what I've been able to learn from churches who have been doing this work, some for a short time, some for a long time, of just some tips and some questions that might start conversations in your various congregations. So here's some just general tips on where to begin. I think it does begin with careful reflection on where we are now, on our current worship services and our welcome and our congregational activities to see what are we doing really well and what could we be doing better. I think it involves asking lots of questions. It's not intuitive to us always on how to do this. Even though we've sort of figured out hospitality well for lots of people, we seem to struggle when it comes to people with disabilities, even though usually the same gestures are just as powerful. I think that these kinds of reflection that you do, and I'll share with you a reflection tool in a minute, should happen with people with disabilities and their family. It's very hard for us often, I know for me, to sort of adopt the vantage point of someone else who might be a stranger or unfamiliar to my congregation. I'm sort of so entrenched in it, and I don't see things the way a visitor might see or a person with a disability might see. So we have kind of an adage in the field of special education that there should be nothing about us without us, right? That's sort of a disability advocacy sort of motto, and I think that's true, that people with disabilities, their families are often able to articulate and share some of those issues better than we are. So start small, but start somewhere and begin with those immediate needs. There might be people who are already in your congregation who can't participate as fully as they'd like before you start moving out to people who aren't currently part of your congregation. So those are just some tips. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to get it right every time, but I think we are called to be trying to do this better. So we do have some reflection tools. I think it's hard to know where to start and what you address first, and there are a whole lot of reflection tools available. What I've pulled together is one that we've done that's really designed, should be as a handout here to you. It's a 6 or 7 page tool. It was designed to be very general, to be applicable to almost any kind of congregation. So you'll see a lot of questions where you're like, that seems a little bit odd. We don't do bar mitzvahs in our congregation. So it's designed to be very broad in that sense, but it just gives you things to reflect upon and gives you a sense of, you know, what might be we doing really well, where might we need to be focusing our efforts. So take a moment just to kind of thumb through it, and you'll see the very first section says whose perspectives were sought as a part of the self-reflection process. And we really encourage lots of people to look at the different areas of congregational life, from the youth programs to the children's programs to what happens when we have potlucks to the small group ministries that we do to the worship services time, because there's lots of places life happens in our congregations. We might have a very accessible sort of worship service on Sunday morning, but all the other things that make up congregational life are really off limits to a person. So this gives you some places to think about and to reflect on, well, what aspects of our church are people with disabilities involved in? What do we do that we don't see their presence or we're missing out on their presence? The other piece that it also gets into, which I'll talk with you in a bit and give you some more tools, relates to our architectural and physical accessibility. So are people present, and then can they actually get into various aspects of what we do in our church? And that helps just thinking about what might be some areas we might prioritize. And then the last sections, which is a number of series of sections that talk about our worship services, our religious education program, our service activities, our outreach, those sorts of things. And it just gives you some prompts to think about the extent to which and ways in which we're supporting people with disabilities. And this really focuses on developmental disabilities, people with disabilities like autism or Down syndrome or intellectual disabilities. But I think it's probably broader in terms of its applicability than that. So that just gives you a sense of a tool that you might collectively as a small group of individuals get together and kind of work through and think about. It doesn't as much give you answers of what to do as it does of areas that you might focus on. But that's another, 6 or 7 pages of documentation to do, and that might be more complicated that you want to focus on. So instead, I thought rather than walking through all that, I would give you what I'm calling, building off those 4 simple questions, 8 easy reflection questions. I think that they're simple and easy to ask. They're not always easy to answer. But you'll notice, I think, is everyone in, these are the 8 questions, is everyone invited? Can everyone get in? Is everyone welcomed? Can everyone participate? Are we all worshiping together? Are we reaching everyone? Are everyone's gifts being used? Are we living life together apart from that Sunday morning service? You'll notice those questions actually don't really have anything specifically to do with disability, although I think we'll be asking them within the context of serving people with disabilities. But they're really more about being welcoming and being a place of hospitality, and so you might apply these to a lot of people who aren't currently part of your congregation and thinking about, so this person, this segment of our community, are they being invited to our church? Can they get in? Are they feeling welcomed? Are they participating fully? Are they sharing their gifts? Ultimately, though, the answer as to how you answer this is different for every congregation. I think tackles different aspects of this in different ways. So I would like to spend the last half hour of this walking through each of these questions and illustrating some ways that congregations in various parts of the countries are trying to answer these questions. And let's start with, is everyone invited? So one of the first questions you might ask is whether people with disabilities are being invited to your congregational activities, right? So if you were to ask the average person walking into your church for the first time on a Sunday morning or Saturday night, whenever you worship, and you ask them what brought them to your church in the first place, why did they come there, what are they likely to say?
They're invited by someone.
Invited by someone, right? Actually, I think that those people who do statistics and research on that say that's actually the main reason people come to church is because there was an invitation to come to that church. And certainly there's other reasons as well. But that's actually probably true for individuals with disabilities as well. So I think, though, when it comes to individuals with developmental disabilities, that this is the biggest barrier to people not being part of our congregations. I think that we simply aren't doing enough inviting. That there are lots of people, particularly with developmental disabilities, who might live in group homes or residential programs, who don't have the connections and relationships in their community. There isn't someone to invite them to your congregation. There isn't a way for them to get there. They're probably not reading about your congregation in the newspaper or getting the flyers that you send out. So the way that they'll get there is because someone takes the time to invite them. And yet those invitations are often the most elusive ones. So I think one of the things that we want to do is, in asking is everyone invited, is making sure that we're letting our community know and families know that we want to welcome them. And that can be done a variety of ways. We can have our kind of passive invitations, and we also have very active invitations, and those are two very different things. How many of you, if there's a if there is an announcement of a birthday party, are likely to go to it? But if you're invited, you're much more likely to go, right? There's a difference between sort of announcing something and actually inviting someone, and I think that is true for congregational life too. So here you see an example of a church sign that says, "Don't worry, be happy, everyone welcome," and there's a little symbol down at the bottom that is a very simple symbol but communicates to people who have a mobility impairment that this church is thinking about them. They've chosen to put that they're accessible right on the front of their sign, and you can see that right here. Interestingly, in a previous session, someone came up to me afterwards and said, "I thought you were going to talk about another part of your sign that communicated something different, the part that says, 'Don't worry, be happy.' And what does that communicate to people who have mental illness or other disabilities along those lines. And I never read it in that light. And it was interesting. I think that sort of goes back to this idea of having multiple people reflecting on what are we communicating to people who come through our congregation doors. So sometimes very simple signs can communicate lots of things to individuals with disabilities or their families. Something like this says, hey, we're thinking about you. We want you to be in this place. All are welcome. And that when someone sees that, they say, they're thinking about me. So I'll show you a couple examples of some websites of congregations. Maybe you go to one of these congregations. Not sure. But here's a congregation that decided right up very easy on its front page. They have a section that says special needs, talks about their Sunday worship service, and they very clearly lay out the different kinds of assistance that make available to people with various disabilities, from parking spots to having ADA-compliant facilities, wheelchairs, sign language interpretation, hearing devices, large print Braille Bibles. So someone who's visiting this church for the first time via their website, which is how a lot of people visit churches for the first time, are going to know this is a place that's thinking about me. Too often we see this and then you go visit the congregation and you realize those don't actually always play out. So we have to have consistency between what we advertise, certainly, and what actually happens in our congregation. Here's another church that advertises its special needs ministry and talks very clearly about that right on its front page of its, of its children's ministry programs, talks about what they offer, and again communicates that we're thinking about all kids when we talk about our children's ministry. There's the websites I put at the bottom of the page if you're interested in seeing these websites later. This is a church out in the Wheaton area, also that talks about its ministry that it has involving individuals with developmental disabilities. And that's a very prominent part of its website. So again, parents see that. So there's lots of ways. These are all what I say passive invitations. They're things that people have to find and look at, and it's not that personal invitation. But often these are 12 symbols that can be used to promote and publicize the accessibility of your places or your programs or other activities for people with a variety of different disabilities. They're all free on the web. They can all be downloaded from the website I have down at the bottom of the page, advertising that we have, you know, closed captioning or sign language interpretation or assistive listening systems or access for people who are blind or low vision. And they can be embedded in the kinds of materials that you share to your community. Here's an example of a website from a church in Canada that puts this right on their front page. It says, we strive to be a truly accessible church. We're scent free. So if people who have sort of chemical sensitivities know they can go and worship there, and that'll be a safe place for them. They have assistive living, listening devices, and they're wheelchair accessible. So those are really prominent. I spent some time a few months ago looking at our Madison newspaper. I live in Madison, Wisconsin, and there's probably, 100, 200 different advertisements for churches. And I don't know those of you who put these advertisements in newspapers what they actually cost, because they're always really brief. They must be really expensive to do, right? There was 5 churches that chose to use some of their space to highlight the fact that they were welcoming of people with disabilities. And you can see those. I've highlighted them up here. One used the access symbol that I talked about. Another chose to use a logo that included a child in a wheelchair. Others have said they're handicapped accessible or they're barrier-free. Those are all sort of passive invitations to children or people with disabilities and their families that these congregations, again, are thinking about them. And one last sort of illustration of how to sort of make those announcements, well, actually this isn't the last, is in Atlanta, there's sort of they call it the Interfaith Disabilities Network. In other places, it might be a Christian Disability Network or a variety of things. But they've put together a list of congregations all throughout the Atlanta area that have submitted sort of the programs that they have for people with disabilities, the kinds of accessibility features that they have. So a family moving to Atlanta can say, I want to find a Lutheran congregation or a Baptist congregation or a Christian Reformed congregation that is going to be accessible and a welcoming place. And they can click on that, congregations that welcome people with disabilities, and find those churches. So they've kind of banded together to make sure that everyone in our community can go to the congregation of their choice as it relates to an accessible congregation. The other thing you might not be familiar with is the National Organization on Disability has a Religion and Disability Program. Anyone familiar with that program at all? They have what's called the Accessible Congregations Campaign. So far, there have been about 2,500 or 3,000 congregations that have signed up to make a commitment to have their congregation, their church building, be more physically accessible. I think they also talk about attitudinally accessible and programmatically accessible. But as I said, there's about 2,500 or 3,000 congregations. There are 103 congregations in Michigan that have made that commitment. Maybe your church is on here. They're organized alphabetically, so it's a little bit hard to find. I think I have all 103 up here, but that's a way also of sort of making that public commitment to being an accessible place. I see a few in Grand Rapids that are listed up here, and a few elsewhere. One of the things that we do in our congregation is that when parents come and sign up their children for the very first time for our Christian education programs, there's a little sign. It's not quite as bland as this. I had to retype it and put it in here. But it says right there where everyone registers, we welcome kids with special needs. We're committed to welcoming children with special needs into our programs and activities. We believe every child is created and loved by God. And it goes on to talk about how you can let us know about your child support needs so that parents aren't have an avenue to know that we're expecting those kinds of conversations and welcome them. And then we still have to figure out then how do we welcome kids really well in our programs. But it sort of parents often say, you know, I was reluctant to share any information because I was worried that my child wouldn't be welcomed if I did, or if I shared too much that would sort of raise flags for you. Other congregations just do simple little posters or things like that. So there's a variety of ways you can do those, what I call passive invitations. But as I said, I think what's really important is that there are lots and lots of people outside of our congregation doors who will never walk into our church the first time, won't see the sign driving down the road or be able to read it or know someone who's going to invite them. And I think we need to do a lot more invitation extending in our communities. And that might mean letting independent living centers or group homes or parent support groups or residential facilities know that your congregation wants the people that they serve to be a part of their congregation, to be a part of your community. And if you're not sure sort of who those organizations are in your community, we put together a list of all the various organizations that are present in most mid-sized, even small cities, and their websites, and you can find out where is the Easter Seals in my area, because they're networked with lots of families. And if your congregation wants to extend those invitations, they would be thrilled to pass that information along. I worked in a group home, and we were thrilled for about a year, and I was thrilled when congregations would say, hey, if anyone sort of who's living in your group home is interested in finding a church, we'd love to welcome them. We can talk with you about transportation and other things. Just let us know. And so those invitations are usually very welcome. So that's the first question, is everyone invited? Second question that you might talk through in your congregation is, can everyone get in? I did an enormous amount of research, and I do believe this is the least accessible church in the entire world. I'm not sure you could possibly be less accessible. This is a church in Germany. The point is that I think our churches and our buildings in many ways reflect our theology, or at least they communicate our theology. And it communicates who's been considered and who's not been considered. And I think you just can't wait until someone arrives at your church to decide to become an accessible place. That has to be something that we do ahead of time. How many of you would go to a place for 2 or 3 hours if you knew there was no chance, or you were unsure there was a chance, that you'd be able to use the bathroom or get a drink? Probably very few of us. And that's the guessing game that many people with mobility impairments have. I love this quote. It's from Mary Jane Owens, and I think it's a challenge. It says, if bars are more accessible than altars, if theaters are more welcoming than churches, if the producers of PBS are more sophisticated about communication access than our liturgists, if the managers of department stores know better how to appeal to those with disabilities than our church leadership, if publishers of popular magazines are more knowledgeable about alternative formats than those who produce religious materials, then we failed to meet Christ's challenge to us all. The rest of society is figuring out, for lots of various reasons, how to reach people with disabilities, whether for marketing reasons or for other reasons. And so we as a church should also draw upon what we already know and also, as I said, be leaders in that. And so that means people have to be able to get in the building. That last step that you see on here communicates a whole lot about our welcome. And in fact, another quote I love from Ed Wood, he says, if shut-ins can go to Walmart, but not to your church, they're shut out. They're not shut in. Again, almost every aspect of society is under ADA and is more accessible often than a lot of congregations. And I know that that's a challenge in historical buildings, and there's lots of resources and places you can go for funding and direction on that. So, but it's efforts we should be making. And here's what this congregation did. Simply was making a ramp that went up by raising the walk a bit. You can see here on a couple of the slides some ways congregations have addressed that just with simple ramps. Right? But it also is not just getting in the building, it's what happens in our worship services and how our space is set up. You can see here's an example of a really nice sanctuary where the only person an individual with disabilities who's in a wheelchair can sit is in the very back row. And yet it would take some very simple steps to make sure that individual can sit with their family or with their friends or in other places. And this is the last quote I think I'll share with you because I love these so much. Harold Wilkie, this is probably 25 years ago, said this. In Las Vegas last year, in five different casinos, I asked five different persons in wheelchairs whether they had encountered any barriers to their entrance. The answer being always, no, should there be. Gambling casinos, okay. Churches, no. And yet, casinos are more accessible than many, many churches. So that's another, I think, challenge to us. So here's some examples of what that can look like. It might simply mean down here removing a pew to make a space for someone, or doing here on the bottom left a curb or a pew cut so that that space is just removed and someone can sit there with their family members, or a ramp up to the platform so that someone can be involved in scripture readings and in the choir and those sorts of things. Those are just, in many ways, very inexpensive responses that communicate a huge amount. I think another part of accessibility that we often forget about is getting people to our congregations. Transportation is one of the biggest barriers for individuals with disabilities anywhere, particularly in our country. And so making sure that people have transportation to and from our worship services, but also to the activities that happen throughout the week. I think that's often a struggle, particularly in cities or smaller towns, rather, that don't have accessible transportation. On a flip note, I do a lot of work with schools. And I do a lot of work around supported employment, helping youth and young adults get employed in the community. And again, one of the biggest issues, barriers to employment, is transportation. And yet, if I were to drive up and down most streets during Monday through Saturday, I'd find that accessible church vans are sitting unused in church parking lots. And I know there's lots of reasons for that and insurance challenges, but what a statement it would be if churches could employ those resources that they do have to help people participate fully in life the rest of the week. It's a huge need, and I think churches could be part of that response. There's other issues around accessibility that might seem unusual to many of us. Issues around chemical sensitivities and being thoughtful about people who can't be in a worship space if there's certain scents or too much perfume and those sorts of things. Some churches, some congregations that are larger set aside a scent-free area, where in that area you don't wear your perfume or your cologne, which, frankly, I think a lot of us would appreciate, right? Especially when you're scrunched up to someone who, well, it's another conversation. food-free zone for people with allergies, young kids who can't be around allergies, and yet we're feeding our little children Cheerios and other things. It's a place that's a safe place. And one of my favorites is a shush-free zone. Many families with or without disabilities feel very judged when their children are making noise. I have a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I'm very aware of that. I heard about this in one congregation where they have a place where it's okay to be fidgety and okay to be a little bit noisy, and we're okay with that. And I was having lunch with someone yesterday who told me about if either his suggestion or a suggestion another church had made about, you know, those cry rooms? How many of your churches have cry rooms, right? So that's where people who are noisy or have babies go when it's too loud. And he had suggested there actually being a quiet room, that we would actually have a separate room in our sanctuary for those people who could only worship under completely silent, still conditions, because most of us are probably okay with a little movement and noise and would feel actually more comfortable. So I like that sort of flip of thinking about it. So those are just some ideas related to accessibility, and you know, it can also be a complicated issue. I'm not an architect. I don't know about ADA regulations. There are wonderful free downloadable resources from all of these different websites that walk you through how big should door, how wide should doors be, how should bathrooms be set up, what are ramp issues that should be addressed. So you don't have to know those things. There's some great tools for that. And actually, most denominations have resources or teams that can help you with those particular issues. All right. So are people invited? Can people get in? Third question, is everyone welcomed? I think we've heard probably the saying, it takes more than a ramp for people to feel welcomed. And those architectural issues, I think, should be a given. The question is, do people feel welcomed when they walk through the door? Do they want to keep coming back? And so part of it's a question of what does it take to make anyone feel welcomed, and do those things with people with disabilities, certainly. But there might be some additional things you can do to prepare. For example, your welcome center should be ready with answers about the supports or the accommodations or the resources or the information that they need for people with disabilities and their families, about what the church has to offer and what sort of initiatives they have. Those are things that should be ready questions when a parent says, I have a young child who might need some additional support in youth group. How do we make that happen? They know who to point to. They're ready with answers for that. It also comes down to, I think, partly equipping our greeters and our ushers and really our congregation members to feel comfortable in welcoming people who, for whatever reason, seem a little unfamiliar to them or seem different to them. I think we often, when we're unsure about talking to someone, when we're worried we're going to say the wrong thing or we're worried we're going to put our foot in our mouth, the end result is we just don't bother saying anything. And so there's some simple things you can share with your greeters or your ushers or your clergy related to just making them feel more comfortable or at ease about communicating with individuals who might have a disability or might be unfamiliar. And so I've put here a website, www.inclusioninworship.org, that has these downloadable little sort of tip sheets for, in this case, guides for clergy, ushers, and lay leaders about welcoming people with blindness or vision loss, welcoming people with mobility differences or with speech differences or with cognitive differences. And I've put together a little sort of tip sheet, basically, about how do you communicate with people with developmental disabilities. Not because you communicate with people with developmental disabilities any differently. You actually don't. We just often think we do. So it's some tips to just help you dispel the myths about that. Another thing that a lot of congregations will do is what they might call an Inclusion Awareness Sunday or a Disability Awareness Sunday or some combination of those. How many of you are in a church that has done some kind of disability awareness efforts? Anyone? Couples? Yeah, I think there's a wide variety of ways of doing this. Often it, you know, looks different in different places, but some congregations will set aside a service or two a year to recognize and celebrate and really invite the contributions of people with disabilities. So there might be worship songs, special music, scripture passages, maybe a guest speaker or a sermon that relates to issues about hospitality and welcome for people with disabilities. These are all websites that have all of those already kind of packaged that you can adapt for your particular congregation and draw upon those however you want. I'm not a big fan of the Disability Awareness Sunday idea because largely it's a stopping point. I think often we do that and we say, great, we made everyone aware. I think it really takes more intentional efforts. It should be a launching point for congregations to really reflect more on how are we welcoming a broader, you know, how are we welcoming everyone in our congregation. So if it's a starting point, I love it. If it's all we do and we sort of chalk it off that we address that issue, I think we haven't probably done enough. But anyway, those are some web resources you can go to. A lot of bulletin resources, bulletin inserts that different denominations have available for download or purchase. This is one related to mental illness by the Lutheran Church. Here's another one by the Presbyterian Church's Disability Concerns Committee that has some talking points and some tips about disability, related disability. Here's one from Bethesda Lutheran Homes that has some posters that you can put up around your congregation about inclusion and disability. And here's another one from the Presbyterian Church that relates to sermon ideas for pastors who are wondering how to address this. So I have a little thing here that would normally be an invitation for audience participation. but I've done three questions and I have 6 minutes. So we're going to pass the audience participation point because I want to get to the other questions. And those are, can everyone participate? So can everyone get in? Is everyone invited? Can everyone get in? Can everyone participate? And I think that's just partly reflecting on what happens during our worship services to really think, are they accessible for everyone? Can everyone really participate in all aspects of our worship service, either because of accessibility or because we've made it possible for a broader range of people to be engaged? Are we encouraging people to be involved in the different leadership events that leadership opportunities that happen within a worship service as greeters, as ushers, as choir members, those sorts of things? Do people know what's expected? Barb Newman, who spoke before me, talked about most of us, when we go to a congregation for the first time, especially a congregation that's a different denomination, are terrified of what we're going to do and what we're going to do wrong. I know that every time I visit a relative's church that's a completely different tradition than ours, I just am terrified I'll do something wrong. For many people who've never been part of your congregation, it's nice to know what's expected when you do communion or what how it looks when you pass the peace or various things. So I think it's reflecting on some of those things and whether our services are really engaging for a broad range of people in our congregation. So churches might make sure they have large print Bibles or large print hymnals and that those things are available. They want to make sure that things like communion and the sacraments and the various traditions that happen within your church are open for all individuals. I hear too many stories about churches that don't want to do communion for individuals with developmental disabilities or won't confirm someone or won't do those things because they're unsure of how or unsure whether to do that. There are a great number of resources that you can draw upon. Here's some up here on the screen that can help you or help your church leadership walk through those issues and learn why that's important and how to do that really well and meaningfully. We often, for adults with developmental disabilities or children with developmental disabilities who have pretty significant disabilities, try to prepare them for the worship service. These would probably be good for lots of people. But if your church, like many churches, send out sort of the theme for next week's sermon ahead of time, they can be things you can talk to and help make people make connections between what the sermon's going to be about in their everyday lives. For people who have communication devices, to make sure you program in advance the scriptural readings or the responsive readings or the songs so that they can participate while everyone else does. That just requires some forethought ahead of time. For kids who have autism, I'd be walking through the routines of what does it look like to walk up and take communion or do those sorts of things and practice those when church isn't in session so that those things are comfortable when church is going on. Or someone who can sort of sit with them and sit next to them and offer explanations of what's happening as you go. So there's a variety of preparation items. If you went to Barb Newman's session previously, she walked through a whole bunch of strategies on that, and she's got some great books that I'll show you in just a minute that you can purchase that talk through those ideas. I should say that families, we should be very thoughtful about families and supporting their involvement in worship. And thinking about these questions, these came from a parent of a child with autism in Arkansas who surveyed 40 parents about their experiences in churches and sort of encouraged these questions, to congregations to ask these questions. How are we supporting families to worship, to be involved in and contribute to the worship experience? Do families of children with disabilities feel watched or judged for the behavior of the children? Are they asked not to return because of their child? Do they trust the children's ministry programs to include their child so that they can worship upstairs or rather than having to alternate? And do they receive the support they need during the week so that they're not so overwhelmed and stressed and exhausted that they just don't want to come to church on Sunday because it's one more place they're going to have to battle those things? So we need to be thoughtful of those as well. The fifth question is, are we worshiping together? As I said, I think a better reflection of the kind of community we're called to be is when people worship together, not in separate places in the same building. So some congregations use what are called faith partners or companions. It's kind of a buddy system where there's a person who's looking out for that young adult with Down syndrome. So when he walks through the door, he's welcomed. They make sure they sit together. They make sure that that person knows what's happening the rest of the week. If they can't read the bulletin, they know when the potluck is. They know when the social outing is. And they sort of help make sure all those things happen. In other congregations, they've adopted this idea of kind of a congregational guide. It's sort of a formal way of talking about a person who, when a family comes or an individual with disability comes, they sit down and talk with them and ask the question, how can we best support you to participate fully in our church? And then they are the ones who then take that information and go talk to the youth leader or to the pastor or to this ministry group and figure out how those supports can be put in place. Because many parents are advocating 6 days a week in their schools and communities, and church is the last place that they want to or feel like they should have to be an advocate again. They shouldn't have to advocate for why their child is being included. And so often a church can sort of demystify that and say, hey, we're ready to have those conversations, and we'll advocate on your behalf within our church. I think another piece that's really important is particularly individuals with disabilities who live in group homes or residential facilities in states, that we recognize the important and acknowledge the important contributions of those support providers who bring them to church, and that we make sure we're giving them a hearty welcome and letting them know the important work that they're doing in providing those supports. Because the involvement of many adults with developmental disabilities in church is highly dependent on whether the support staff on that particular day decides they want to take them to church or not. And so I think we need to welcome them and support them as well. Two, three more questions in just a couple minutes. Are we reaching everyone? I do think we need to probably think about how we do worship. This is probably good for everyone. I know that this is what this conference is about. But are we willing to change our expectations for what's okay during worship time? Is it okay if some people are allowed to stand? Are we okay with a little more movement, a little more music? Can we be okay with those things? Can we be okay with my friends with developmental disabilities who might just answer the pastor's rhetorical questions? Is that okay? Probably so. So those are some things we need to think about. And then from the pulpit, are what people are hearing about themselves, people with or without disabilities, but particularly people with disabilities, hearing about themselves affirming, or is it not? A lot of the language we use, we have to just be careful about it, not for purposes of being politically correct, but in terms of using language that's affirming and positive and not putting people in boxes and focusing on what they can't do. And a lot of the language and metaphors we use probably need some rethinking from the pulpit. The seventh question is, are everyone's gifts being used? And I think that that's just part of being an interdependent community. Are people with developmental disabilities having opportunities to serve and use their varied gifts in the same way that everyone else is? And it may take a little more practice or a little bit more intentionality to make that happen, but the gifts of people with developmental disabilities are just as rich, just as varied, and just as needed in every congregation. So we have to strive to make sure that they're actually being used. I'm sure this fella can preach like no one else, but does he have the opportunity in our churches to do that? And the eighth question is, are we living life together? Because I think it's really hard for 2 hours a week to feel welcomed and then the other 6 days a week to be on your own and isolated. And so as we leave sort of our church doors and as we pack up the coffee and the donuts, I really think we should be leaving the church together and living life the other days of the week. Many people are at the margins of their communities and really need to be known throughout the week. So those are eight questions that I would encourage you to sort of reflect on in your own congregation and think about how well you're doing, what are you doing well, what could you be doing differently, what could you be doing better, and what would be your next step. And I would just also encourage you that lots of congregations are on this journey, so you don't have to figure this out on your own. There's a large number of really great resources and networks of congregations I'd encourage you to check out. And the resource I'd point you to most important, which is free and downloadable at the website down here and on your handout, is The Dimensions of Faith and Congregational Ministries with Persons with Developmental Disabilities and Their Families. It's a resource of resources. It's a map of everything out there, videos, curriculum, books on this particular topic. And as I said, there's a number of different books. I've written a book on this topic. Bard Newman, who's talked before, has a couple books on helping kids include kids and autism in your church, and I'd encourage you to check those out. So I went 4 minutes over, but it was worth it, I think, I hope. This is my contact information. I hope you will contact me by phone or email if you're wondering things or if you're discovering things in your congregation. I'd love to hear about it and love to kind of journey along this with you. So thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.